Okay, these sources are going to tell you all that went into bringing this to us. Now, part of that, of course, is canonization. But Masora is about Masora. How has this been passed down to us? Moshe Kipotor Gisinan, who must tell Yoshua, Yeshua to his king, his king to Leviim, Anshiknes Asagadola. We've discussed that until now. But the actual words, how does this come down to us? Right? So the first thing to start with is probably the actual letters. Right? Did the Aseret HaDibros look like this? Or, as you might see on page, it's 24. Here is a metamorphosis of the Hebrew language over the ages. Page 24 in your Chovera.
Right?
Chovera
online.
Oh,
you can find it online.
Why do you think? Page 24 gives you a metamorphosis of the Hebrew language. Okay? It's always called Hebrew. In fact, the Talmud is well aware of this. There are many midrashim that refer to these two types of script. Yes?
What about the Midrash that says that the Samech and the Mem Sofit?
That's when the Gemara discusses this, it asks that very question.
Is that in the language there? Is it the same kind of thing? Where it's, like,
it's all page with that Gemara on it before this. Okay. So this Ksav is called Ksav Ashuri, either because it is Meshura, it's much more ordered, much easier to read than the earlier Ksav, which is called Ksav Ivri. Ivri, Hebrew. Okay. That earlier Ksav is what we always find on ancient documents, ancient get a talk, yeah, you'll see, I'll show you jugs with names on it, letters that were written from Lachish to Jerusalem. These Lachish letters we're gonna get to. Always in Ksav Ivri. Anything found from Bayis Rishon is in Ksav Ivri. Right. Does that seem to point in the direction of the ancient Ksav being Ivri rather than Ashuri? Some archaeologists think yes. Ashuri is called that, according to one opinion in the Gemara, because we only started using it after we returned from the exile of Ashur. Okay? When Ramban made Aliyah to Israel, he found a coin with letters on it he couldn't read. It was Ksav Ivri, right? You probably have seen these ancient shekels. I should have brought one in. I have one. Right? We certainly have seen facsimiles of this shekel. Usually has a lulav and an esrog on it. Some others you see there's an esrog in the corner usually. And he took it to some of the locals Jews who had been living there for a long time, probably Samaritans, Karaites, and they could read it. They were able to read it. He writes about this find in his parish, the very last parish of his on Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the end of the Torah. He writes about this find, and he did research about it, and it draws him to the conclusion that the ancient Ksav was actually Ksav Ivri. But that's the Ksav we were always using. Right? When it switched over to Ksav Ashuri, are in these sources. On page 25, source number 4 is a Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. I did not ask you to prepare this, so I'm going to read it. Source number 4 on page 25 tells how Ezra was just like Moshe in many ways. And if Moshe had not revealed the Torah to us, Ezra should have, or could have, or would have. So what's Ezra's reward for being so great if he didn't get to give us the Torah? Gemara says, Nishtana al yado haktav. Read again. Nishtana al yado haktav. So it means that Ezra established this difference between Ivri to Ashuri. We'll get to your question in a minute, because that's in there. Amazingly, this Gemara doesn't ask that question. It's a different Gemara that asks it. Okay? Should have been here, or at least Tosfos should have written something here. This is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and everyone leaves it alone. But you're not, and you won't. Right? So apparently, according to this Gemara, it seems, until Ezra, we used Ksav Ivri, right? And then Ezra changed over the Ketav to Ashuri. The Gemara doesn't tell us why he did this, or... Right? Languages tend to evolve over time. I mean, letters. But, okay... There is a clear difference between the nature of the two alphabets. Ksav Ivri is largely hieroglyphic, meaning the letters look like something of the sound. Mem is that because it looks like running water. Ayin is an I. Okay. I must say Ktav Ashuri is somewhat hieroglyphic as well. A bet looks like a bayit. A dalet looks like a piece of a delet. A gimel looks like a gamal. A chaf looks like a kaf. You see some of our letters. A vav looks like a hook. In fact, afterwards, when the Gemara insists that Ksav Ashuri was always there because of a medrash you mentioned, right? That already in Aseret HaDibrot, the mem and the sama stood miraculously, right? That means there could only be because of, right? You see this little piece here? That should fall away if you engrave through and through. Torah says the engraving went through the stone. So you could see an olive through a stone, right? You do the artwork, you ever see this, right? You can make a dalid and carve this out, and you'll see a dalid through this into the next room, right? But if you carve out a samach, right? You carve this out, this middle piece is gonna fall away too, right? So what was the miracle? That little piece of stone stood in the middle. You get it? It wasn't a whole out, rounded out circle. Just the edges of the circle were rounded out to make a samach and a mem, mem sofit, dafka. But the inside stood there. This famous mimer, mem v'samach shebaluchos b'neis hayu omdim. Right? Which implies, get it? That already at the time of Aseret HaDibrot, long before Ezra, right? The letters were already Ksav Ashuri. Okay? So the Gemara gives this answer. Shokchum v'chozrum v'yastum. Shokchum v'chozrum v'yastum. They originally had Ashuri. They forgot it. He brought it back and he established that it should be Hebrew. Ashuri. So it starts Ashuri, goes to Ivri, and then back to Ashuri. You have to ask the archaeologist, or the archaeologist is going to ask you, so why don't we ever find a single ancient find? We have scores and scores of ancient finds with Hebrew writing on it. We'll learn that when we do archaeology. Not one has Ksav Ashuri. They're all Ksav Ivri. We found Birchas Kohanim, we found references to David HaMelech, we found references to wars fought in Tanakh, we found, I told you about the Lachish letters, they're all in Ksav Ivri. Right? So, what answer does the archaeologist give? What answer do we give? Everything was written down back then. But Ksav Ashuri was limited to Torahs. Of course we don't have a Torah from back then. It's written on parchment, which long ago devoured. Right? What's the oldest material we have in Hebrew that's of the Torah nature? What we find in the ancient times are just jugs, letters, personal notes, a piece of leather where someone carved out a name, right? What's the oldest material we have on the hand? Come on, it's obvious, yes? Dead Sea Scrolls are in Ksav Ashuri. You can read it, right? Dead Sea Scrolls are in Tzava Shuri.
But they're also from Baruch Shem.
Okay, in Echanami. But that means that by the time of Dead Sea Scrolls, 150, 180 BCE, we do have... But there, it's not only Tzava Shuri on Chumashim, Torahs, commentaries, but it's... Mr. Friedlander, tune in. Okay? Okay. Please remember the system of how I'm grading you. All right? At the end of the semester, you're not going to have tests to determine what grade you got. It's my determination. Don't just kiss up to me, but stay with me. All right? Okay. So, but it's true, whatever we have to buy is Rishon, pre-Ezra, is always in Ksav Ivri. I would love to have a pair of tefillin or a mezuzah, but nothing like that exists. Right? We don't have a Torah from the 7th century. We're not going to have one from CE. We're not going to have one from the 7th century BCE. Right? Okay? So, I'm just putting out the opinions before you. Okay? Ramban says that it was Ivri to Ashuri. He knows there's a Gemara that says Ashuri Ivri Ashuri. You get it?
Is that only one opinion, or is that the final?
So here's the point. Well, if Ramban is going to outright flout a Gemara, what's he relying on? Right? We can see in this course the Rishonim were not afraid to do something like that. But he's relying on something ironclad. There is a Shita in the Yerushalmi, it's source number 3 on this page, that says, Ayin Shebaluchos B'neis Haya Omeid, a source you didn't know because no one teaches that source. It's Yerushalmi, right? We all know that the source, Mem B'samach Shebaluchos, it's Gemara in Shabbos, Gemara in Megillah, everyone heard of it, right? But there's a Yerushalmi that no one teaches, the Ramban quotes it, that says, Ayin Shebaluchos B'neis Haya Omeid, because if you look at the chart here, Ayin in every generation is constantly the I. Okay.
Is this the packet that was given today?
No, it's not. No. Packet is in your computer, right? Or just print it out, and you'll all have it. Okay. So you see the Ayin always looks like an I. It's always a full circle. There are some others that look like circles, but the Ayin is the only one throughout it that remains a circle. Plus, in Ksav Ivri, there are no Sofit letters. Got it? There are no Sofit letters. The Mem is the same in the beginning of the word and at the end of the word. All right? Okay. YU.EDU. Benjamin Abudi? Bob Alberstone? Nathan Alper?
Yep.
Daniel Avraham?
Yeah.
Roy Ben Shimon?
Yeah.
Eliran Buchstaber?
Here.
James Capel?
Yep.
Itam Dechter? Yosef Friedlander? David Levy?
Yeah, here.
Mika Pava? Sam Rabinowitz, Yosef Rosenfield,
yeah.
Avidan Rudansky,
yeah.
Alex Lutsky,
yeah.
Jonas Stavsky,
yeah.
Adam Aaron, Menachem Tehani,
Manny.
What? Menachem?
Manny.
Is that your last name, Tehani?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
I'm serious about the way I want to run this class, okay? Talk to me after. Okay. All right. So what you have here is the dispute based on these rabbinic sources over whether the letters were Ivri or Ashuri. Everyone seems to agree that at some point they turned to Ivri. That's indisputable, right? The question is, was it originally Ashuri and then brought back? Simple enough, let's move on. Okay, that is the Mesorah on the letters. But now let's talk about the actual text itself, and on that we are on page 15. Or I should say, we're on page 16. Sfaradim may be more familiar with this story than Ashkenazim. There was a Sefer Torah kept in Aleppo. Not too many Jews left there now. But Aleppo was the main Jewish community outside of Israel for hundreds of years. Right? Not just in Syria, but in the Arab world, Aleppo was the main Jewish community, and they kept a famous Torah that they called Keter Aram Tzova. The crown of Aram Tzova is the capital of Aram, and that's Aleppo. Right? They kept this Torah for hundreds of years. They claim that it's the most authoritative Torah that is known to us. I just want you to be aware of the story. There was recently a novel written about what happened to this Torah. According to news reports in Israel, for the first 20 years of Israel's independence, the Torah was thought to have been destroyed by Syria at the time of the Declaration of Independence. If anyone knows any family members who were in Syria at the time, in much of the Arab world, terrible pogroms all over the Arab world on the night that Israel declared independence. The Muslims of Syria knew that the Jews had this treasure. It was kept in a lower basement in a safe, and hardly anyone was ever able to actually see this treasure. And the word, it did disappear after the night that Israel declared its independence. But it's a very entertaining description the name escapes me, but I think it's called the Aleppo Codex, C-O-D-E-X. That's the name of the book. And I'm not going to give you the ruin, spoil the book for you, but suffice it to say that about 20 years later, it surfaced. This for the Jews, this is like the Mona Lisa going lost and then returned 20 years later, right? So here is some of the intrigue about the Jews. The reason it's important for us, for Jews and us in this class, is that it's by far the oldest Torah that we have. It's not because we haven't guarded our Mesorah, the Christians and Muslims at times, but the Muslims much less. They appreciated us as the people of the book. Christians were very efficient at destroying whatever they got their hands on. Right? They took a lot to the Vatican, which is hopefully we'll get back one day. And they have these airtight rooms where these things could last. Our Torahs would long ago have been digested by worms and destroyed in floods and fires, if not for some of these being taken and kept in pristine condition in those airtight rooms in the Vatican underneath the ground. So be that as it may, the interest for us in these few pages I gave to you, page 16 through 19. It's an amazing story. You read these four pages, and then you read that book called the Aleppo Codex. It's really a fascinating. Anybody aware of this intrigue before today? Any Syrian family?
No, I was born and raised in Yemen, so we have similar stories to that. And when he said something about how Muslims appreciate us as the people of the book, I think in Arab countries, which is a lot of people were kind of poor and. Actually, the same story happens with my family last year when we went to Yemen. They had a Sefer Torah, which is around 500 years old, and all they wanted was to get their hands on it to make profit off of it. And I think that happens throughout history in a lot of places.
So that is probably what happened with this book. I don't want to spoil the intrigue of what happened to it. We have it now. It's in the shrine of the book. You know that white Hershey kiss. You know that it's in Yerushalayim near the Knesset. You know, it goes up like that, right? So it's in there now, right? So what's of interest to us is that if this is the oldest Torah, it doesn't necessarily make it the best Torah, right? The Torah has over 300,000 letters in it, and all it takes is one to be mistaken to make it puzzle, right? So here is what the intrigue is for us in this class. The Rambam, writing in the 12th century, refers to two families who have excelled at guarding the Mesorah. The families are Ben Naphtali and Ben Asher. right? He prefers this family. He thinks that they were preferable. They were more expert at guarding the Masorah. But what emerges from here, when the Rambam mentions these two families and then says, I prefer one over the other, he is admitting that there's more than one Masorah for what's written in the head differences. You know what I'm saying? And the differences could be significant. Right? You ever see on Lysol, it says, this kills 99.999% of the germs in your bathroom, right? Great, that still leaves 400 million germs, right? In other words, if 99.999% of the Pesukim of the Torah are correct, that still leaves you with 10 mistakes, all right? I need 100% correct, right? So, the Rambam says that I prefer the Ben Naphtali approach. We don't have any Torahs that say Ben Naphtali on it, or Ben Asher, for that matter. I don't know what these... We don't have any surviving members of these two families, but listen to what these two families' job was. Families had hundreds and hundreds of identifiable members, and this was your job. Bereishis Perek Aleph, Bereishis Perek Beis. And by Perek, I don't mean what we have as Perek Aleph. That was done by Christians in the Middle Ages. What they really meant was Parsha Aleph. The Torah is divided into parshios, about 160 different traditions about how many, about 160 to 165 different parshios, and you read a parsha a week. It's a misnomer to refer to this week's parsha as Nitzavim Vayelech. This week's sidra is Nitzavim Vayelech, right? Parsha, open up especially a Koren Tanakh, and it'll give you on one side the prokim that this Christian bishop established, which is just convenient, so that Bibles use it, even the Hebrew Bibles, right? And on the inside, you'll have the parsha number. What does number 162 look like? They used to read the Torah every 3 years in Israel. There was a Babylonian, the Talmud Bavli, established the custom to read the Torah and finish once a year. But originally, the minhag was to read much less, about a third at a time, and the Koren Tanakh tells you where each parsha begins and ends. Okay? So every member of the family got a parsha. They were about the same size. Divide the Torah by 162, and you figure out it's something like just 300,000 letters. Each person is getting 300,000 divided by 162. It's not a lot. Something in the area of 40 to 50 pesukim. That's your job. You know what your job is? For the rest of your life, every single day, I want you to know how every word in your parsha is spelled. Bereishis, Beis, Reish, Aleph, Shin, Yud, Tav. That's all I have to do. Well, next, Bara, Beis, Reish, Aleph. Well, if you have a pasuk in Parshas Ekev, where it says, Me Reishis Shana, Ad Acharis Shana, any Bakara here? How do you spell that word? Mereishis Shana. No Aleph. There's no Aleph there. If there's an Aleph in that word, it's take out the Torah and don't read from it. You're not allowed to read from it. What you would have to do is scrape off that whole word, right? And then write it a little bigger without the Aleph in order to use that Torah. Okay? There are hundreds and hundreds of misspelled words in the Torah. This is irksome. I'm going to discuss that. That's our next discussion. All right? The word toldos is spelled four different ways in the Torah. Who would allow such a thing? This is a divine text. How can you have four of the same words in the Torah spelled four different ways? Right? This way only once. But these more often. Okay? So your job was, you take your parsha, I want you to memorize your parsha. Right? So that if ever there's a question, you will always have your way to, someone will ask you if there's a question of the Aleph, because we darshan these things. And these were the ways they remember it. There are texts, they don't, you know, we don't print any Mikros Gedolos anymore this way, but on page 34 of your Choveret, I gave you a 1905 edition of a Mikrovsky Dolos. It's printed in Lublin in 1905. And in this type of Mikrovsky, does it look a little familiar to you? Usually a very thin, long Mikrovsky Dolos. In this version of Mikrovsky Dolos, there are these little notations in the middle of the page. You see it here? Right? This is known as Misora Katana. It tells you how often particular words, unusual words, are found in the Torah or Tanakh. Right? Okay? The word Kishloshim says Beis Mole, or Lamit Lesa Chose. It's telling you different notations of how this word appears. It's telling you that the word Shloshim never appears anywhere else in Tanakh where both the Vav and the Yud is missing. But here it is. Right? These are little notations that these family members gave on unusual sounding words. You didn't have to do a notation for Bereshis on the first word of the Torah. But you did have to do Bereshis, the Rashis in Akev. There's a note there that says, never again is Rashis spelled without the Aleph. This is the only place. Right? So they made these special notations for unusual spelling, unusual words. That's known as Misora Kitana. Got it? There's the notations
in the
middle. Right. Why Katana? I get that name. I mean,
if we're not going to start this whole time, that's the
Misora. Because the Misora Gedola at the bottom of the page tells you where to find sometimes where there's another place where it's spelled like this. Okay? If there's no other place, then you don't have to write such a thing. Right? I'll give you an example. When the Torah writes, the first time the Torah writes the word Eicha, the beginning of Devarim, the Misora Katana writes Yud Zayin. It's 17 times in the Tanakh the word Eicha appears. There's no Misora Gedola on that, except in one place. One of those 17, the Misora Gedola at the bottom of the page tells you where the other 16 places are. Which one would that be? Where would you put the notation where the other 16 are? Come on, which Eicha in Tanakh would you most be able to find me in this Tanakh right now? First Pasuk in Eicha. That's where the Misora Gedola, they're strategic, and where they can tell you, let's say you wanted to make a drasha about where else Eicha appears. So you look up the Misora Gedola in the place where you're most likely to remember where it is, and it'll tell you where those other places are. This is 1905. No Mikros Gedolos since. And I'm sure not any will include the Misora Gedola or Katana anymore. Tell me why. Because if you want to do something like that, there's another book published just before then. It's called the Concordancia. You ever hear of this? You know what the Concordancia is? Concordance? No? Never opened the Concordance? Concordance is an alphabetical listing of all the words used in a particular genre. It's a concordance. Shakespeare, is that a pen? That's... It's not so much because it's just, I mean, Shakespeare has thousands and thousands of words in all its corpus, but the Tanakh has millions of words. And this is an alphabetical listing of every word that appears in the Tanakh. So if you want to look up Eicha, you don't have to go wondering where I'm going to find the Misora Gedola. Just open up a concordance. You following? You understand why there's no need for this anymore? All right? But this was the work they originally did. Okay? Following? So we don't know who Ben Naphtali or Ben Asher is today, but here is the intrigue of what I gave you on page 16 to 19. Does the Keter Aram Tzova that was in Syria, that now is in the shrine of the book in Yerushalayim, does that reflect the positions of Ben Naphtali? Can we tell with some degree of certainty by the way the Rambam describes, and there's plenty, he describes what is the Misora of Ben Naphtali. Can we determine that that is reflected by this text? Okay? And the answer is in these four pages. So here's a short story. In the 30s, where the Jewish community could see that things are getting very, very... very tense with the future of the Jewish place in the Arab world, in Europe. So there was an attempt to take some pictures of some pages in of the Keter Aram Tzova, just so that someone outside the Syrian community can have some record, some test to see if the main point was, is the Rambam's description of the true Torah, is it reflective of what's written in the Keter Aram Tzova? Right. So there was a man by the name of Umberto Casuto who survived the war. He lost children in Auschwitz. But he survived the war and went on to become the head of the Bible department at Hebrew University right after the war. And they wouldn't let him come in with a camera. They frisked him, couldn't take pictures. But they gave him 10 minutes to look at it and to see if you could. So here's a Bible scholar. You have 10 minutes. What can you do in 10 minutes to determine whether this is Keter Aram Tzova or not? He was smart enough to know what he should do. Now, since then, of course, we can just go to the shrine of the book and see. But what he did was he looked at Parshas Ha'azinu, where the Rambam writes in the Mishnah Torah that Parshas Ha'azinu has to have all together, right, a certain amount of lines in it for the Torah that it's written on in to be kosher. If you have a different set of a number of lines in Parshas Ha'azinu, you're reading a trade Sefer Torah. There are other signs the Rambam gives for this, but he only had 10 minutes, right? Got it? Now, in the printed editions of the Rambam, for some reason it says 65 lines. 65. You go open up any Rambam, except the New Frankel one, which has corrected it. And all the Rambams that we've had for hundreds of years since printing, it says if that Torah doesn't have 65, I have it all here, it's all on these pages. If that Torah doesn't have 65 lines, you're reading a Pasuk Sefer Torah. In other words, to him, the Keter Aram Tzova, the Ben Naphtali Torah has 65 lines. Right? However, now we have the Rambam's own handwriting. We have the Mishnah Torah and the Rambam's handwriting. That's what you're looking at the bottom of this page and the top of this page. This is the Rambam's holy handwriting. And in the handwriting, the words, it says, Sheva v'shishim shitos. I don't know how that mistake ever crept in. How does the Rambam's handwriting say 67 and the printed editions of the Rambam say 65? He was very depressed. Casuto didn't have the Rambam's handwriting. He was very depressed because he read 65 in the Rambam and he counted 67. Right? He wanted very much to prove in those 10 minutes that the Keter Aram Tzova, which they feared would be destroyed with all the upheaval, they thought the Nazis were going to take over Syria soon. Right? They saw that some terrible things happening. He wanted to give some definitive proof that what was in Syria reflects, that the Rambam was aware of it and reflects what he thinks is the true Sefer Torah. This is not necessarily utterly conclusive, but you have is that in the Rambam's own handwriting, the answer is that it could be that this reflects the true text. Right? That's significant that we have such an old text, that we don't have any older texts. I'm sorry to tell you, is just a matter of our, who knows what we'll find in the Vatican. Right? Okay, so this is. So I would now say we do have a representation of the Ben Osher tradition in the Aleppo Codex. Right? Okay, now remember what I told you before about the work of the Bali Masorah, the families. You got Parsha Aleph, you got Parsha Beis, you got Parsha Gimel, right? So we don't have any of that work. The best we have is this Masorah Katana and Masorah Gedola, right? However, there's one very popular commentary. I call him a commentary, but he's a collection of Masorah. He's so popular, he's been published in most Mikros Gedolos, some on the page of the Mikros Gedolos, but in most at the end of each book. He's known as the Minchas Shai. Minchas Shai, 17th century. Shai just stands for his initials. His name was Shlomo Yedidya, right? Minchas Shai is whenever there is, this is what your go-to guy, if you're laning, and it happens sometimes, could be a printing mistake in your Chumash, or it could be because You know, they're different. Sometimes one chumash has one word, and another chumash has another word. He's your posting, right? Minchas Shai. Who left him in charge? He just. You know, what makes someone consider the last word on something? Okay, that's his name. Minchas Shai. He was so popular. He was been published in and his lots of work. Look at his work just on Parshas Akev. All of this is in Parshas Akev, where he has noticed that there are different versions from one Torah to another, right? And he tells you what is the correct version. It's sort of like the Rambam is telling you, with Ben Aftoli is better, he paskins for you. Right? Okay, got it? Okay. So I will go to the next level now. Two things. One is that there is a Gemara in Maseches Kedushin that says there are 5,888 Pesukim in the Torah. The Minchas Shai on Vayikra Perek Chet Pasuk Chet, what does that look like? The middle Pasuk. Right? It's our middle Pasuk. Minchas Shai on that Pasuk says, our sages tell us that this is the middle Pasuk of the Torah. What's the problem?
It's an even number.
You can't have a middle Pasuk with an even number of Pesukim. Right? So he writes on this pasuk, he says, our sages tell us this is the middle pasuk, but how can that be if the Gemara in Kedushin tells us they're 5,888? So he says, I counted all the pesukim, right? Everybody knows that there are not 5,888 pesukim. There are 5,845 pesukim. That's true. What happened to 43 pesukim? Good questions?
I was going to say, when the Christians separated, made their own version, did they keep the Pesukim the same, and just change
yes,
the
yes, the Pesukim is part of our Masorah.
They don't change the Pesukim.
They just change the Pesukim.
Okay.
So here is a dilemma. What happened to 43 Pesukim? So he, on that middle Pesuk, right, when Eliyahu comes, he'll give us the answer. Teach me the targets. But let me share with you a tshuva that actually I saw once in a shul. It happened in my first shul on 84th Street. This actually happened. And it was this week's parsha. It was the Tzavim Vayelech and the Kohen. I don't know how this happened. I know how he wasn't corrected. I must have been sleeping myself. The Kohen gets his aliyah. He says the bracha afterwards. And then someone says, wait a second, you only read two psukim. An aliyah has to be at least three psukim. Right? You only read two psukim. So here I'm called upon right on the spot to paskin. My first shul, I was 23. I was a little kid. This was shul, a lot of people in shul. And here I have to, and people are arguing in the back of what to do. Lucky for me, this was already a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein took this exact situation. He didn't say it was parshas v'yitzam v'yelech. What happens if you lay in two psukim? Right? This was like so fortuitous for me, because knowing what to say here kept some of these holy guys in the back who were against having such a young guy be the rabbi of the shul in the first place. But Rav Moshe asked me the following. He said that if those two psukim are long enough to sustain possibly three psukim, right? In other words, you can fit three esnachtas within those two psukim, and you can see the first two psukim in Tzavim are very large, right? Then he does not have to say the bracha again. But if one of those psukim is Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor, and then the second pasuk is pretty short also, you couldn't get three psukim out of that, right? So then you would have to start the aliyah again, and lay it, and say the two brachas once again, right? It's probably why the guys stopped laying after two psukim. Because there's such long psukim, he thought he lay in three, right? So why does Rav Moshe say that? He points to this Minchas Shai, and he says, it's not that there are 43 missing psukim. Your point, there are 43 large psukim in the Torah, right? Where they used to be two different psukim, and somehow we lost the sof pasuk between them. You got it here? I'm saying here? So he says that since this is Midrabanan anyway, to relate three psukim for an aliyah, So if you can possibly fit three psukim into these two, don't say the bracha again. And I just said, I just told him what to do. No, go Levi, go, next. And then afterwards I gave a, you know, I always gave a little halacha at the end of davening. I used that as the opportunity to explain that. And it went over. Right? Because Rav Moshe said, okay? All right, do you get it? Rav Moshe said that maybe one of the two psukim at the beginning of Nitzavim was actually bunched, and he actually did read three psukim. He just missed the sof pasuk. Okay? Good. All right, so we'll... Okay. The next is let's talk about some of Ezra's work. Ezra had a difficult job. He's bringing the people back. He had Nehemiah and Zerubbabel doing the political work for him. Ezra had to do the religious work. So the religious work involves bringing the Torah back to its original form and study. Okay? And on, let me give you the proper page here. It's on page 26. Okay. On page 26, there's an amazing source. It's source number 9 at the top of the page. Actually, it names names. On page 26, the Medrash says, that when Ezra came back from the Galus, right, he found multiple Torahs. This source just says 3. I think it really means 300, but it says 3 for a particular reason. Let's get it. It says he found 3 Torahs in the Beis HaMikdash, hidden way underground that the Babylonians didn't destroy or loot. And he took these 3 Torahs, and with these 3 Torahs, created an Ur Torah, meaning the correct Torah, the Torah from which everybody from now on will write mezuzahs, tefillin, whatever the other Torahs. All right? He used these bits. All he had, there were only 3 Torahs left in all of Israel. And he sat down 3 students, and he said, okay, you read the first word. Bereishis. How do you spell it? You read it. Bereishis. Okay. The new Torah is going to say Bereishis. Okay? Got it? It's Torah A, Torah B, Torah C. Now, 99.999% of the time, all 3 were same word, same spell. Got it? But comes our Gemara, and it names names. It tells us when there were discrepancies. It tells you the psukim. That in some places, Ezra found that 2 Torahs said, let's say, black, black, but Torah C said white. So, of course, he would go with black. Right? He always went with the majority. That's the end of the source. And it gives you 3 examples of where 2 Torahs said Za'atute, I'm sorry, Atzile, and the 3rd Torah said Za'atute. Ever hear of the word Za'atute in the Torah? Of course not, because he didn't choose that one. It says Ve'el Atzile b'nei Yisrael lo shalach yado in Parshas Yisrael. Okay? It's actually Parshas Mishpatim. So it talks, it gives 3 specific examples. Radak says there were many more, but he always went with the majority. So I have a bunch of problems with this source. 1, what if he's wrong? All right, we'll deal with that another. That's a philosophical question. The majority will always turn him to the right direction. What if 2 judges say guilty and 1 says innocent and the 2 were wrong? Right? What if 2 rabbis say it's treif and 1 says it's kosher and the 2 who said treif are wrong? Achir rabim lahatos. The rabbim are right, even if they're wrong. It's not an infallibility clause. There are ways to turn things back. There are appeals. But acharav mahatos, we go after the majority, and that majority is hashkafically pointing us in the right direction. It's as simple as that. Right? So Ezra, the second problem is, what happens if something like this happens? You see what's going on? This is in Bereishis, this is in Shmos, and this is in Vayikra. right? What he's basically doing is that it's very possible, since there are so many words in the Torah, that his new fourth Torah, Torah D, right, which now has B, B, and B, right, from there, is unlike any other Torah. He just created now a fourth Torah. He's basing his new Torah on something that is different than the other three. This is why the Radak insists it's not three, it's 300. Right? Because what eventuality does this source not even entertain? It's a Sefrei, it's an ancient source. It's as old as the Mishnayos. Right? This Mishnayos doesn't entertain the real possibility. No? Any statisticians here? This source doesn't entertain the real possibility that all three are different. What if one is black, one is white, and one is blue? Then what do you do, Ezra? The answer is no, that's because it's not three. It's inconceivable that all Torahs were destroyed by three. No, there were 300. It's just that three gives us a nice two in one. But there were 300. And usually it was all 300 the same word. But in numerous cases, it was 290 like this and 10 like this. Those 10 are totally discounted. That scribal error or the ink ran. It was supposed to be a chaf. It looks like a pay. Keep it a chaf. The other 290 point us in the right direction. But here's the Radak's finish. Some cases, it was 160 this way and 140 that way. What do you do there? Too many had the other one. Right? Remember in the first day of class, I told you when parentheses are like this, don't read what's in there. So why write it? Because a lot of manuscripts have it. When you see parentheses like this, brackets, read it. So why put brackets there if I'm supposed to read? Because a lot of manuscripts didn't have it. You with me? That's okay in a Talmudic page, but you can't put parentheses in the Torah. All right? So what could Ezra do to indicate this is an ingenious Radak? It's just it goes against the Gemara, two Gemaras. It's ingenious. What could Ezra do when he ran into situations where he could not clearly determine discrepancies? 288 like this and 12 like this. That's obvious. What did he do?
He'd write it one way and said read it another.
Correct. Creepsy. Right? Okay. He would do what's known as kriuksiv. You're familiar with the phenomenon?
Yeah.
It's spelled one way, right? And it's, last week we had two radical kriuksivs, right? If you're about Korei, the word was spelled tishkalena, and we read tishkavena. The word was spelled tchorim, and we read afolim. God's name is a profound kriuksiv. We don't read yud hey and above and hey, right? We're reading a whole different word. Yerushalayim is a kriuksiv. You know that Yerushalayim is never spelled with the yud between the lamed and the mem except in three cases in the whole Tanakh. Esther, Yirmiyahu, and Divrei Hayamim. Every other place it's Yerushalayim. It's not. There's no yud there. Look, open up a Tanakh and see. Words are spelled one way and they're sometimes pronounced another way. Right? So that's the Radak's logical explanation of that phenomenon. Right? There's a Gemara in the Nedarim that calls this phenomenon Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, and you have some aforeshim when and there are halachas in the Gemara that determine kriyuksiv. Right? Okay, it's an interesting thing, but the Radak is saying something that's logical, and Ezra wasn't sure. Sometimes he wrote it in the margin, and so, you know, this is called pre-veloksiv, ksiv-velokri. Sometimes the word is that we don't read it at all. Sometimes the word isn't there and we read it with it. That last phenomenon does not happen in the Torah. It happens in Megillas Rus. It happens in Sefer Shmuel. It happens in Shoftim. There are some the concept happens. Yes.
What is written? What is read? Is the one that's that majority of
the pshat is the way you read it. That's what the pasuk means.
That would be the majority one. Like you found 160 would be the one that you read.
Yes.
He
wanted to give some credence to the minority one, so he wrote it, sort of like, and then they put parentheses around it, but put it in the margin. Okay, Ad Kan. So on Thursday, we will hopefully finish our section of Masorah. Guys, come with your material, okay? The material, page 16 through 35, okay? Come with the pages. All right, have a great day, everyone.
I was just wondering why, like, if they're asking you both to everyone's name.